That, of course, was a vastly different time than now. My grandparents lived in a very, very small farming community in western Ohio. One of the many things that many things that my grandmother and I enjoyed doing was walking through the countryside. She was always up for a walk through the countryside. We could walk anywhere. Farmers had no problem whatsoever with us trekking through their fields or their woodlots, and the only requirement was if we opened a gate, close it, keep the cows in. My grandmother knew about the plants and animals, and she knew where the watercress grew in the creek and why you couldn't eat the watercress because fields had cows in them. I'll leave that to your imagination. She knew the trees and the wildflowers and when and how they grew. She knew their names. She knew a lot of the scientific names. I don't know where she learned that, but she also knew usually two or three local names for them. She knew their stories. Over time, I absorbed her deep respect for them. Then there was Aunt Ruth. Many of you have heard about my great Aunt Ruth before. Other sermons. I believe she was a pagan, although I don't know that she knew the word. I think my grandmother probably was a pagan as well. Theirs was the Church of Nature. Aunt Ruth had a large backyard with just an absolute riot of flowers and trees and a small pond that seemed to produce frogs and toads out of nowhere. Like my grandmother, she had a deep respect and affection for these beings with whom she shared her life. Particularly in the summer months, her life was just a dialogue with what went on in her backyard. I absorbed her sense of that as well. So for her, it all had personality. As an adult, my deep kinship with the natural world continued. I discovered that for me, being in the natural world was healing, was restoring. And whatever my connections with other humanly created religious organizations over the years, I have maintained my dual membership in the Church of Nature. It's this sensitivity and this sense of things that led to this service.
When she was 34, Elizabeth Tova Bailey contracted a mysterious illness that left her with severe neurological symptoms, keeping her confined to bed for over a year. A friend brought her a pot containing a violet she had collected in the woods. As it turned out, the pot contained not only a violet, but a snail. In her book, The Sound of a Wild Snail Eating, Elizabeth Bailey describes her evolving relationship with the snail in meticulous detail. We pick up her story shortly after she acquired the snail. What would I do with it? As tiny as it was, it had been going about its day when it was picked up. What right did my friend and I have to disrupt its life? Though I couldn't imagine what kind of life a snail might lead. One evening, I put some of the blossoms from a bouquet of cut flowers in the dish beneath the pot of violets. The snail was awake. It made its way down the side of the pot and investigated the offering with great interest and then began to eat one of the blossoms. A petal started to disappear at a barely discernible rate. I listened carefully. I could hear it eating. The sound was of someone very small munching celery continuously. I watched, transfixed as over the course of an hour, the snail meticulously ate an entire purple petal for dinner. The tiny, intimate sound of the snail's eating gave me a distinct feeling of companionship and shared space. It also pleased me that I could recycle the withered flowers by my bed to sustain a small creature in need. I might prefer my salad fresh, but the snail preferred its salad half dead, for not once had it nibbled on the live violet leaves that provided its sleeping shelter. One has to respect the preferences of another creature, no matter its size. When I woke during the night, I would listen intently. Sometimes the silence was complete, but at other times I could hear the comforting sound of the snail's minuscule munching. In the morning, I'd look for the tiny earth-colored creature. Usually, it was in the flower pot, asleep, its familiar shape reminding me that I wasn't alone. After weeks of round-the-clock companionship, there was no doubt about the relationship. The snail and I were officially cohabiting. I was, I admit, attached. I felt some guilt that it had been taken unasked from its natural habitat, but I was not ready to part with it. It was adding a welcome focus to my life, and I couldn't think how I would have otherwise passed the hours.
Thank you, Carolyn. My husband's sister, Maureen, mentioned the title of the book, The Sound of a Wild Snail Eating to Him. I read a sample of it and very shortly had the whole book in my possession. I would highly, highly recommend it. It's not really a page-turner, as they say. It's... But it's totally intriguing. I mentioned it to my daughter, which got an eye roll of the first order, but be that as it may. I don't talk a little bit about this hymn, When the Summer Sun is Shining, as well. I don't think we've sung it before. The tune is easy, however, and you've heard it in Jim's prelude. It's a hymn tune originally written for the song Brethren, We Have Met Together, which is one of the oldest among published American folk hymns. I saw the words, I looked up the tune on YouTube, and sort of immediately fell in love with it. It's an old, old, old Appalachian four-note, shape-note tune of the type that I came to love while I was living in the Southeast while I was in graduate school. I spent a lot of time listening to that kind of music. Caroline reminded me this morning that it's also the tune, some of you may be familiar with this song, Go Tell Aunt Rhody. Unfortunately for the old gray goose of that song. So, hymn number 66, When the Summer Sun is Shining.
Species and habitats lost to climate change, using the words of Erica Barton. We now take the time to acknowledge all those already lost as the world feels the effects of global warming and climate change. Thousands of people, as well as animals and plants, die every year from the effects of global climate change. As we acknowledge those lost, please respond, we remember you. To all those people lost to extreme heat waves,
we remember you.
To all those people lost to floods, hurricanes, mudslides, and other disasters caused by changing weather patterns,
we remember you.
to all those people lost to hunger as crop patterns change.
We remember you.
To all those people lost to drought as weather patterns change.
We remember you.
To all those people lost to disease as the environment shifts.
We remember you.
To all those animals, siblings of flesh and blood, breath and bone, whose lives have been lost as global climates change.
We remember you.
To all those plant spirits, siblings of the green world, whose lives have been lost as global climates change.
We remember you.
To all those species lost forever as global climate changes.
We remember you.
We remember you, and we commit ourselves to restoring balance. So may it be.
So may it be. It's a good reminder of the damage that happens and is happening. We do not and cannot live without doing damage to the environment that encompasses and sustains all of us, in which we live and move and have our being. In a recent book, Upstream: Selected Essays, Mary Oliver writes about the dilemma posed by our necessity for food. Her precise and unflinching prose is not, however, for the faint-hearted. Of appetite, of my own appetite, I recognize this. It flashes up quicker than thought. It cannot be exiled. It can be held on a leash, but only barely. Once, on an October day, as I was crossing a field, a red-tailed hawk rattled up from the ground. In the grass lay a pheasant, its breast already opened, with only a little of the red, felt-like meat stripped away. It simply flew into my mind that the pheasant, thus discovered, was to be my dinner. I swear I felt the sweet prick of luck. Only secondly did I interrupt myself and glance at the hawk and walk on. Good for me. But I know how sparkling was the push of my own appetite. I am no fool, no sentimentalist. I know that appetite is one of the gods, with a rough and savage face, but a god all the same. And Teilhard de Chardin says somewhere that our most agonizing spiritual dilemma is our necessity for food, with its unavoidable attachments to suffering. Who would disagree? My own version, by the way, of Oliver's dilemma here is that despite my commitment to not being violent against other beings, I make special exception for ants when they are foolish enough to wander into my house, and I'm swift to swat at mosquitoes that bite me, although, to be honest, the mosquitoes are still pretty safe at that point. But I've also found that as I have gotten older, I have abandoned my previous vegetarian diet, needing the concentrated nutrition that animal foods can provide. But I'm aware of that. There's always a little bit of nagging guilt there. Elsewhere in the same book, Oliver acknowledges and celebrates a different impulse, though. And once, too, I gave something back. A friend left us a bluefish. I went down to the edge of the water to clean it. When I had it scaled and slipped the sharp knife into its belly flesh, it broke open. Not from any carelessness of mine, but from fine necessity. The bluefish had been feeding on small fish, sand eels, and its stomach, like a red and tensile purse, was stuffed full. Pieces of sand eels fell out, and among them maybe half a dozen were intact, squirming, unhurt in fact. So quickly, without a moment's warning, does the miraculous swerve and point to us, demanding that we be its willing servant. Swifter than thought, my hands scoop them and plunge them into the cold water, and the film of their sibling's death fell from them. For an instant, they throbbed in place, too dazed to understand that they could swim back into life, and then they uncurled like silver leaves, flashed away.
In introducing their book, Earth Prayers, Elizabeth Roberts and Elias Amadon remind us that we are all part of a much greater ecosystem, a planet-wide organism that is indivisible. If we accept that we are totally part of this living earth, then we must recognize that isolated health is an illusion. All healing involves making whole again, resolving the contradictions that exist between self and other body, body and spirit, mind and nature. Knowing that we are not encapsulated, self-enclosed entities, but rather fields of energy integrated with the environment, everything transforms and reshapes the world. If our actions can destroy, so can they heal. In this light, there is no difference between work and prayer, no distinction between physical activity and the work of the spirit. Precisely in the restoration of this balance between body and spirit lies the path for healing the greater whole.
The litany for the environmental Sabbath is found in that same book of Earth Prayers by Roberts and Amadon. Let's now join together in a litany from the UN Environmental Sabbath program. Please respond with, "We join the earth, we join with the earth and with each other," as indicated in the italic type on the screen. We join with the earth and with each other to bring new life to the land, to restore the waters, to refresh the air. We join with the earth and with each other to renew the forests, to care for the plants, to protect the creatures. We join with the earth and with each other to celebrate the seas, to rejoice in the sunlight, to sing the song of the stars. We rejoice with it and with each other to recreate human community, to promote justice and peace, to remember our children. We join with the earth and with each other. We join together as many and diverse expressions of one loving mystery for the healing of the earth and the renewal of all life. We conclude our tribute to the earth and the other beings with whom we share it with Mary Oliver's words again from Upstream. I would not talk about the wind and the oak tree and the leaf on the oak tree, but on their behalf. I would talk about the owl and the thunderworm and the daffodils and the red-spotted newts as a company of bodies, as well as spirits, as well as bodies. I would say that there exist 1,000 unbreakable links between each of us and everything else, and that our dignity and our chances are one. The farthest star and the mud at our feet are a family, And there is no decency or sense in honoring one thing or a few things and then closing the list. The pine tree, the leopard, the Platte River, and ourselves. We are at risk together, or we are on our way to a sustainable world together. We are each other's destiny.